finish the concept of Eilu Ve'ilu. So yesterday we told there was a very basic question which we ended up with, which was the question of why, especially since the Rambam failed, why the Shulchan Aruch succeeded in becoming the final word in areas which he ruled upon for all time. So in order to understand this, I'm going to give you my theological perspective, which is more of a kind of a mystical perspective, and then I'm going to tell you something interesting besides that, which is the mystical perspective, which I believe to be true in this case, is that we mentioned that a few days ago that Torah is what shapes the world, meaning that the world in its totality, and I'm talking about its physical reality, is a manifestation of what the Torah says. By that I mean that, for example, he said that people have fathers and mothers because the Torah has this abstract concept of honoring one's fathers and mothers. And so too, everything in the world is a crystallization. It brings into concrete form ideas which the Torah represents. And that's why it says that Hashem Yitzakel V'Raisu V'Ra'am, Hashem looked into the Torah and created the world. And that's why the rabbis say that the Torah, as it is written in heaven, is written in the form of the letters, the arrangements of letters with which heaven and earth were created. They were reassembled when they were given to us because we need to understand them in some way which is our mind can grasp. So therefore they are reassembled in ways which are we can understand. But in theory, the way it's written, the way it's written before was given to us, it is written in an abstract way in which it represents the names of which Hashem created heavens and earth. Now, when we also generate Torah Shabbat Peh, in other words, all of us have the capacity to generate a new Torah. And we generate new Torah either by, in fact, saying new novel ideas or having new novel insights, or by simply unknowing, learning in our particular way, things which existed before. But everybody, by definition, since everybody's different, everybody senses and perceives and absorbs Torah in a slightly different way than everybody else. So therefore, everybody contributes. In the sum total of Jewish history, everybody contributes some aspect to this tremendous and complex tapestry, this tremendous and complex entity, which is the developing Torah over time. Some people contribute more directly, some people more indirectly, but everybody has something to contribute. Otherwise, it wouldn't all have been created. So now, if there's some point in Jewish history in which all Jews, or I should say the overwhelming majority of Jews, accept something to be true, then that becomes the truth, which determines the reality of the total world. Not just the reality for those Jews who accepted it. That would be true if individuals accepted it. That would determine their reality. Or, as we said yesterday, if there was a rub in a certain location, he determines the reality, and that's what I mentioned the case yesterday of the guy who has lung disease in Volozhin. So he determines the reality of his location. But if you have all the Jews in all the world, overwhelming majority of them accepting a specific perspective, a specific benchmark, so then that becomes the reality for all time subsequently. And there's no way basically to change that, to revoke that. And there's a lot of ramification for that, which is based on a little bit on the mysticism, which is brought down by Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz, the Tumim, when he discusses Ilchos Shemishpat, the laws of monetary issues. There's a law in matters of Chesh and Mishpat, a monetary law. You don't follow the majority. Meaning, let's say 99 rabbis say that on a certain type of court case, a certain type of litigation, Reuven, the claimant, should win the case. And the plaintiff, Reuven, the plaintiff, should win the case. And Shimon, the defendant, should lose the case. And one guy comes and says, one rub says, one legitimate authority comes along and says, no, in my opinion, Shimon should win this case. So Shimon could say, you know what, it's true 99 people say like him, but there's one person who says like me, I don't like that one person. Right? Now if it comes to court, you can't say that really, but if it doesn't come to court, you can say, keenly, I hold that one posting. Prove to me that posting is wrong, then you can take away the money from me. But until you can prove that to me, I get to hold like him. So the terminology for that in Hebrew is, or in Aramaic actually, kimli. By me, it's sustained like this one individual. I don't have to accept what you're saying, even though you have a tremendous amount of evidence to bring to bear, doesn't matter, since I have one legitimate authority who says like me. Who says that the Yonatan Eibschitz in the Sefer called the Tumim, He says that which a defendant can say kinli is the only way it doesn't go against the Shulchan Aruch. It's only if his claim does not contradict the Shulchan Aruch and Rambam. But once the claim contradicts the Shulchan Aruch, so then I say he doesn't have the right to make that claim anymore. That's assuming, you know why? Because it's so obvious that the Shulchan Aruch and Rambam were written with Ruach HaKodesh, they were written with the divine inspiration, because so much is compacted into the very few words of the Shulchan Aruch and Rambam that any other opinion which they did not include is clearly wrong. Because God led them to write this the way they wrote it. Now that in of itself, as I mentioned earlier in terms of Gemara, that in of itself would not be reason enough for us to accept it as universal. But since the Tanya Shulchan Aruch recognized that that's the case, so therefore they accepted it as universal. You understand the difference? In other words, we're not accepting it because it's divine. Rather, because it was divine, people saw that it was worthwhile to accept it. I'm not sure I'm coming out clearly. Again, the reason why it's binding, perhaps I should say this, the reason why it's binding is not because it's divine, but rather, since it was divine, people accepted it, and since people accepted it, therefore it's binding. So the reason to accept it as binding was the fact that the logic to accept this binding was the fact that it is so divinely inspired. That's not what actually makes it binding. It's acceptance. But once all of Amishol accepted the Shulchan Aruch in that way, so from that point on, nobody can argue the Shulchan Aruch anymore. It's not 100% true. It sounds good, but it's not 100% true, because you find that the Shach, the Taz, sometimes the Vilna Gaon, the early commentators do argue the Shulchan Aruch. When we talk about Shulchan Aruch, we don't just mean the Mechaber, the Ramah in the middle, but we mean all the guys on the page, so to speak, right? All the commentaries on the page together, they comprise the Shulchan Aruch. And you have to follow them since that time.
I found that there was some things that were really open for interpretation of Shulchan Aruch, you know, so I guess you'd need a teacher to get it really done. You know, one it was in the area of Tefillin, they were talking about long hair, having this long hair, which they said in and of itself is a transgression, having long hair, so I don't really know, you know.
What bothers you about that?
No, I don't know, is it so absolute? I mean, how is it open to interpretation?
And what's constituting long hair? I mean, Rav Soloveitchik had one of those classic, you know, sweeping back hair things that was not long in back, obviously. But
there's a question, well, long hair itself usually means, not always, usually means a ponytail.
Okay.
That's in our day and age, right? So,
right.
I mean, in their day and age.
And Gemara also.
Oh, really?
You know, Gemara talks about blorit, that's a long hair which is forbidden to have because, like, non-Jews have that point about ponytail.
Yeah, it's one day
because
I was
over there
on Saturday night.
Jews do have ponytails, but that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Or pigtails.
Yeah. Pigtails are okay. So I think the pigtail is usually, in English it's yasser, a ponytail is two and pigtails is one. Isn't that the way it is?
No, pigtail.
No, pigtails are two.
Ponies only have one tail.
Oh, ponies have one tail.
But
pigtails
also have one tail.
Right.
I'm not sure where the illusion is.
Okay, you're right.
Pigtails
are permissible, right?
Ponytails
are prohibited. So then,
the pigtail in the back of the...
You have your hair like a man's shoes.
No, I'm fine. In any event, so the idea, which, again, I think this is from Sonic, but also from Amelia Mayer Bluff, is that once something is determined, and it's by either a rabbinic belief, which we don't have right since the time the Sanhedrin was disbanded, or something is determined by acceptance, then that becomes the benchmark. And that's interesting because the halacha is that a rabbinic decree doesn't take effect unless it's accepted by a majority of Jewish people. It goes back to the time of the Gemara says there was a decree made by Daniel. Daniel, he appears in Tanakh, he's a big guy, right? And Daniel made a decree that people should not drink Shemen Akum. I know, drink is the right word. People should not use oil produced by a non-Jew. Olive oil produced by a non-Jew. At the same time, they purvey wine produced by a non-Jew, bread produced by a non-Jew, stuff cooked by a non-Jew, and oil produced by a non-Jew. So the Jewish people at the time drew the line. They said implicitly, not explicitly, listen, Rabbi, wine, okay. Not stuff they cook, okay. Bread, to a certain extent, okay, they didn't accept that completely either. But oil, we draw the line there. We are not accepting this decree against oil. And they, again, they didn't necessarily say it explicitly, but they made it implicit. So in fact, it didn't stick. Right? Oil makes it not stick. So in fact, there was a basis later, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, who was the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who formally rescinded the decree. But in fact, it was already many years before, it was no longer applicable. So I tell you, there's a very dangerous tshuva, I don't think I mentioned this last, very dangerous tshuva by Moshe Feinstein. Very dangerous means it can lead to all sorts of negative repercussions if it's taken literally. So I'm going to tell it to you now, right? I'm going to take the risk and tell you a dangerous tshuva. Are you ready for this? Okay? And when Moshe Feinstein speaks about the issue of why people clap and dance on Shabbos. You'll notice that people today clap and dance on Shabbos very often. The Gemara forbids it. The Gemara on the Septa basis says it's forbidden to clap and dance on Shabbos. So everybody asks the question, you know, why then is it permissible? Why do people actually clap and dance on Shabbos? What makes it permitted? So in fact, you know, maybe it's permitted, but there are a couple of answers which are given. One of them, for example, is given by the Minchas Aluzer. Minchas Aluzer was the Mukach Rebbe before the Second World War. He said that had Chazal known about Hasidim, they were never forbidden clapping and dancing. Because really, Misnatsim, they shouldn't clap and dance because they don't do it for the sake of their divine service. They just do it because they feel like they're having fun. But we, it's an integral component of our Avodas Hashem, and therefore for us it's certainly mutzi to clap and dance on Shabbos. I'm not making this up. So the Minchas Aluzer said. But Moshe Feinstein doesn't go into that kind of logic. And Moshe Feinstein says, the reason is because that aspect, that a rabbinic decree has to be accepted by the majority of the Jewish people, has to be true throughout the existence of the decree. I mean, let's say, 1,000 years later, the majority of Jews stopped keeping that rabbinic decree, the rabbinic decree falls off. For example, let's say all of a sudden we start a mass movement not to keep Hanukkah anymore. Right? So then, if our mass movement was successful, we could successfully overturn the holiday of Hanukkah. Now Hanukkah probably doesn't bother you that much, but let's say the second day Yontif, right? We could also do that second day Yontif stuff just by, you know, making a mass movement in which everybody refuses to keep second day Yontif anymore. In theory, according to our mother's
mind.
That's why it's dangerous. That's what he says about clapping and dancing, even though one time the majority of the Jews adhered to this prohibition, since now they don't adhere to it, so therefore it falls off. Yeah?
Why did they forbid it in the first place?
Because you might come to fix the instruments. Once we let you make all sorts of sounds, you might want to make more professional sounds.
Which
one asked for? That's a tactic of mine to make you forget your question.
Oh, it seems that many people who keep at the Humra, they don't drink not Jewish oil.
No.
There's no Hasidim on the side of the like this at the
Humra. You won't find anywhere oil which says Shemen Yisro.
Why? Like, why do?
Because it's hello.
There's not people who think that I have my gold for it,
but we still have to have an OU on it.
No, it seems that, I mean, I feel guilty buying this, so I don't do it, but it seems that cold-pressed, extra virgin olive oil is not even quite right extra whatsoever.
Probably not in America.
Saving money.
What?
Probably not in America.
Anyway.
This America, it's kosher, most likely are you going to be
like... No. It doesn't say kosher. It doesn't say kosher.
I mean, if something is kosher in America, they're going to get you to give extra. If there is no extra in America, there is some that it's not kosher.
No, but I'll tell you, it's not true.
Why it's not true?
Because the cold pressed virgin olive oil has no additives. It's just pressed olives. It's what's used in pressed olives. So in theory, it doesn't need a hasher. Later on, the other olive oil, which is not extra virgin cold pressed, though they extract by heat, or they use chemicals to extract the olive oil, so that packet needs a hasher. But the original cold pressed stuff doesn't need any hasher. What?
Cannot buy it
from America. Sure you can. First of all, yeah.
Whole food stores.
No! It's not the Pathmark.
Have food stores.
Yeah.
No. Oh, they don't have Whole Foods here, do they?
Any food store sell them. The thing is that There are other surprises like that. People have a misconception that all products need a hechsher. They don't actually all need a hechsher. For example, sugar doesn't need a hechsher. Only for Pesach. Salt doesn't need a hechsher. Only for Pesach. But salt is salt and sugar is sugar. Flour also shouldn't need a hechsher, except that, you know, you have to make sure that it's not imported from somewhere like Israel. But in theory, flour shouldn't need a hechsher either.
So I mean, dry powdery goods.
Natural dry powdery goods, like not processed. I didn't realize that was so funny.
I
thought my line before about oil not sticking was a better line than that one. So there is nobody who actually keeps Shem and Achim. It doesn't exist, right? Even if you go to Chassim and Muncie, they don't do that, right? They might only buy oil as a hechsher, but the oil that buys a hechsher comes from the same place. You know where most olive oil comes from, of course.
Italy?
Same. Even the oil which olive oil comes from Italy originally comes from Spain. It doesn't actually,
What was the deal with, I don't know, but my brother told me this one, that if you eat olives, it increases your forgetfulness.
It's more in Harios, yeah.
Olive oil, it increases your memory?
Right.
It's not
how it is. What it says is the one at the end of Horios, one of his small disciples in Jack, Jackson says that, yeah.
Hasidim don't eat any olives unless they spray some oil on them.
Now you know your problems in all these years, right?
I know. I've been eating too many olives.
But you don't remember anyway.
So moving right along. So therefore, you know, if the idea is that something has to be accepted in order to be valid, so we see clearly that the acceptance of Am Yisrael of a certain thing, Torah law, of course, you don't have to accept. God decreed it. God inherently made it part and parcel of creation. But rabbinic law, its real validity is only when it's accepted by all Jews. Once it's accepted by all Jews, though, it becomes part and parcel of the inherent nature of creation. And therefore, if something of, like the Talmud is accepted by all Jews, or the Shulchan Aruch is accepted by all Jews, or maybe someday, although it's unlikely, the Mishnah Berurah will be accepted by all Jews, so then that becomes, I know you don't like that, I'm sorry, that becomes the benchmark of the benchmark and the standard, and you can't deviate from that. Yeah.
You said that if all Jews decide at what point not to accept rabbinic
Feinstein, yeah.
Yeah. Then it no longer has the same authority that it would fit. So if universally in the future the majority of Jews decided against the Shulchan Aruch, then that would not exist?
And have to also be political. It's important to know, right? You always forget what the majority of Jews today are not observant, right? So all Torah should fall away, right?
Yeah, why? Well, so it used to be the majority of observant from Jews, right?
Right, but why is the majority of observant from Jews?
Because they're not even Jews
at
the time.
What?
The Jews are matters. They're part of the process of engaging it at all. They're the ones who learn it, who study it.
I don't see them study. I don't know if it requires knowledge. I think it's, what? Right, so therefore they don't count because they don't get mitzvahs anyway. So there's somebody who keeps mitzvahs, and this mitzvah, they decide that, you know, a campaign was waged, you know, or a birth campaign wouldn't really work, would have to happen on its own. But and this mitzvah, that, you know, the rabbinic law, so then it wasn't accepted. But if you're not accepting the whole concept of mitzvah, so then, you know, there's, you know, it doesn't matter. So, you know, we don't take it into account. Actually, it's important to know. That, you know, the conservative, until relatively recently, so I would say maybe 5-10 years ago, they actually pretended to follow some halachic system. They didn't really, but they pretended that they actually lived followed some halachic system. It's just that it was not the same system as the Orthodox. Yeah,
that's why they were conservative.
Right. Has anybody ever heard that argument before? Right. That was the argument, that they really... They're not walking through the suit, just that their definition of halacha is different. So the problem is, why is that not true? I mean, so, you know, they said, listen, we're halachic Jews, and we believe, in our halachic perspective, one is allowed to try to shul on Shabbos. Right? They didn't just say, we don't believe in halacha. That's what the Reform Jews would say. We don't believe in halacha. But a conservative Jew would say, no, it's a rabbi, a Jew, a layman couldn't care less. But a rabbi would say, you know, no, we are loving Jews, and we came to a logical conclusion. I say, for instance, to drive the Shul and travel. So, let's say even they did claim to come to a logical conclusion.
But
Allah can't contradict the Torah. That's the problem. No, that's not so much a problem because, you know, they claim didn't contradict. You want to know what the logic was?
Right. Was it on fire?
Two logics. One was that an internal combustion engine is not fire. You see the fire in an internal combustion engine?
No, it's internal.
What?
I've never seen one.
What do you mean? Never opened the hood of your car?
Well, listen,
no.
In my car, it's from time to time.
I
get to see the fire.
What?
In my car, from time to time, I get to see the fire, but that's when I pull over.
Yeah.
It's an internal combustion engine.
An internal combustion engine.
Fire.
We don't see the fire take place, and therefore, that's this fire. Right. Besides, you know, that had the Torah didn't forbid internal fire. It forbid external fire. Fire of which you cook, you know, not fire of which lights in place inside the engine. The other logic they use is that, besides that, it's pikuach nefesh. It is considered to be saving a soul to allow people to drive on Shabbos, right? If you know that saving souls, I'm not making this up.
And who would give the mitzvah to a guy? You've got to have a Jew do it.
Right.
Clearly.
So saving souls, obviously, is something which pushes off all prohibitions of the Sabbath. Therefore, if you don't let them drive to shul, they're going to go off to, who knows, the golf course or the movies, and their souls will be lost to the Jewish people. This way, we have to let them drive to shul in order to save their souls.
And then they go off to the golf course or the movies.
Yeah, I mean, that means it's safe.
Why
isn't
it still Kasher if they have sex?
What?
Why isn't it still Kasher if they have sex?
Different rabbis give different logic.
No, I thought that you have a kid belt, like his hairy car, like clothing. You don't
what?
Your seat belt, like carrying your car, it's like clothing. You carry my shirt, right?
Very good, okay.
You're
a real Talmudic scholar,
right? Like it's about joke, honestly.
I'm considered a conservative
smitten. Yeah. Wait a minute. So, the idea is, but it's irrelevant. The fact that this logic, by the way, if you want, you can look this up in the, I forget which year it is, in the 1950s sometimes, I think the early 50s. In the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly in Skokie Yeshiva, where I was in Chicago, so they had a full set of the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly, the Conservative Movement, and that's where I went to read their response on the topic, and this is what they say. So I stress I'm not making this up. So let's say theoretically, there was even some halachic validity to this, hypothetically, right? So then, they still can't decide halacha because in order to decide halacha, you have to believe in the system. If you don't believe in the system, you just say, well, I can prove to you that halacha would say this, but I really believe that God didn't give the Torah Mount Sinai, that the Torah was written by human beings, right? And there was no direct revelation, only indirect revelation. There's one place in the conservative statement of belief. It's called Emet Ve'emunah. It's a 55-page pamphlet put out by the conservative movement, defining their principles of belief, what took the Rambam 13 sentences to write, takes it 55 pages because they have to cover all the various different opinions. And one of the acceptable opinions in conservative Judaism is that the Torah was written by, quote, God-crazed individuals, end quote. So therefore, you know, if you believe that the Torah was written by...
God, you're crazy?
No. People who were rendered crazy by the inspiration of God. Was they were given a very high level of spirituality. So the idea is that it's not really part of the system. In order to be part of the system, you have to believe that God, there is a God, first of all, which is optional in sort of Judaism, and that God came down. The way God is defined in reform is the sum total of all forces in creation.
It's God created the earth and then he left it alone.
No, it's not even that. That's not even a God. It's not even a God. Creation always existed. But it came to its own. But there are many forces and they all make up a great...
How is that monotheism?
You ever watched Star Wars?
How is that monotheism?
What?
How is that monotheism?
How is that monotheism?
Yeah.
There's only one force.
Yeah, Yes. Monotheism is not Hebrew.
Because all the forces are merged into this one force. But in
there are many midichlorians that help you comprehend the force.
I've actually never seen Star Wars. I've heard comments.
It's also the Schwartz.
I reckon, but...
Still a remaining question about that Moshe Feinstein. He said that the majority of Jews decide one way and then it becomes a part of this world, and then if they decide against it, it can become not a part of this world.
Right, that's his novel idea.
I don't understand how something could, that the majority of Jews decide it can become part of the world and then stop being part of the world when they change.
Why is it body?
Well, it seems like...
There's a few stories about the Kutzker Rebbe. The Kutzker Rebbe is supposed to have said a side story. The Rambam does not believe in demons. He doesn't believe that they exist. He writes in the Shulchan Aruch, in his commentary, Shulchan Aruch says, the curse of philosophy led the Rambam astray. Right? Of course they're demons. So the Kutzker Rebbe, who was a very sharp Hasidic Rebbe of the early 19th century, he writes, they're both right. When the Rambam said there were no demons, so the Rambam decreed, God fulfilled, all demons ceased immediately to exist. When the Vilna Gaon came along and said there are demons, so all of them came back into existence again.
Thank you, Vilna.
Because the Rambam. Now, actually, it sounds very strange, but it actually is a very good, even though it sounds strange, it's a good way to understand how things work in creation. We have this with Tzadik Gezer of Gershboro Matayim. God made righteous people his partners in controlling and governing the world. So that means they have a say. If Rambam says, listen, God, this is the way I understand things, so God made them partners. God committed to, deal with the world as his partner tells him to deal with the world. God didn't have to commit himself. He's always come in and say, okay, game's over, bye. But he doesn't. He did commit himself. And he doesn't say game's over, so that's why he has to follow the Rambam. And along comes the Gra many years later, and the Gra says, well, they do exist, so God has to follow the Gra. Because that's how God created the world. He created the world so that the Tzadikim are his partners and ruling heavens and earth.
I'm sorry, where's this from?
What?
Where is this?
This cluster?
No, this statement that the righteous people are the partners in creating.
Oh, I don't know where it is. Okay, I have to look it up. I'm sorry. Tzadik Gra is of a Kodesh Baruch Hu Mekayim. I don't know where.
Oh,
okay. There's a good book set. I think they have them maybe in the basement. It's a green set, three lines. It's worth buying. It's called Michla Ma'amorim Lapis Gamim, the Encyclopedia of Statements and Things. And that actually is a place you look up things like that to find out where they are. Michlo. That is the rabbi's handbook.
Michlo.
Ma'amorim. The remarkable thing is that it was put out before computers. Now everything's easy to find, but no one's very hard to find stuff. So, have I answered the question or is it not happy?
You answered it, but I was...
Oh, I only asked part way. Sorry. I only asked part way. But it's all about Tzadikim. So now it also says that the world is created for the Jews, right? The world is created because it says the way Chazal say it, the word gracious, first word in the Torah, is an acronym, if that's the right word, for Bishvil Yisrael Shmiku Reishis. It was created for the Jews who are called the firstborn of Hashem. So it means that Hashem created the world. He had in mind that who's going to make the world run?
The Jews.
What they do makes the world run. And he, Hashem, is forbidding to abide by what the Jews decree. And that's why it says in Bar Mitzvah that when the rabbi said they rejected Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanu's position, and they said, no, we're the majority, he's the minority, we rule as the majority, that God in heaven said, at that time somebody made Eliezer know and asked him what was God saying in his eyes, so they said, Nitzchuni Bonai Nitzchuni. Nitzchuni. So the simple meaning of that, Nitzchuni Bonai Nitzchuni, is that my children vanquished me, they vanquished me. right? And when Aser, in most of modern Hebrew, means to vanquish, to conquer, right? And in fact, the word Netzach also means to eternity. And what does the, what Hashem was saying on a different level, I don't remember what it says in my show, in my rock, that what Hashem was saying on a different level is that they eternalized me in this world. Because I created the Jews that they should have this power, and that this should be demonstrated for all eternity, that the Jews, meaning human beings, helped me shape the world. That is demonstrated for all eternity by the fact that the Jews, in this case, are able to override me, so to speak, and rule against me, and rule that this type of oven, which is being discussed in Domitia, is unclean, is tummy.
Sorry, just say the little translation for this again. As it would be in Domitia.
Domitia would be that they vanquished, they were victorious over me. Yeah, means to vanquish, but also, Netzach also means eternity. Yeah.
What about people who keep only written Torah, trying crimes nowadays?
Yeah.
They basically, they can undo or rabbi into law for them.
They what?
They can undo or rabbi into law.
They don't believe in rabbinical law.
So,
you have to believe in them to do
that. They really believe, because Torah itself has they don't believe in this part of Torah.
Right. They believe that something else. Means that the rabbis tell you, but not there's anything binding. So there's no specific things the rabbis tell you which is binding. I don't know if I'm making myself make it up. Maybe it's up there. When it says that they would say what it says to follow rabbis, it means, well, go to your rabbi and ask a question. But you go to another rabbi and ask him and get a different answer, that's also okay. Just consult the rabbi.
So I don't depend on being a Gaon. I depend on you and some rabbis and some rabbis. I don't care about what Shulchan Aruch says. If I go over to you, it's enough, right?
Right.
And you can make up whatever you want.
Right.
You help me.
Right.
Which is not valid nowadays, so, anyways, right?
Yeah, we still make stuff up.
it's not like
the right smith, the rabban smith. Yeah, the arrow smith, okay, the rabban, right? They used to say that when Moshe Feinstein used to give out smicha, so smicha consisted of a beautiful document, beautiful parchment, which had your name, the of Moshe Feinstein, and on the back there was a sticker, in case you needed to ask any real question for Moshe Feinstein's phone number. It was on the back. That was what the smicha was.
He gave a lot of
smicha
nowadays.
Well, nowadays it comes without the phone number. It comes without the phone number nowadays.
If you call, you'll tell him.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to handle.
Yeah.
You can get a hold of a Bible to Rebbe nowadays, but not very much to find out.
That's one thing that sort of freaks me out. One time I asked, Mashiach. So, how do you ask the Rebbe? We ask him and he'll give us a divine sign. And in my mind I'm going, what? I'm dead? They go like, yeah, we read it and he's constantly telling us something new. To me, that's how... Tupac doesn't even do this much.
Who's that? You talked to Tupac?
Huh? Yeah.
Forgive my ignorance, who's Tupac?
A rapper who died about 10 years ago.
Not dead.
And he's still releasing songs to this day.
Okay. Him and Elvis, I guess they're called collaborating. But, be that as it may, whatever they believe, it's unfortunate, it's a sad thing to what happens there. But, the smicha nowadays really just means that you pass the test. It doesn't mean you have any... But it's what it meant 100 years ago, too. It meant you passed the test on specific areas of Shulchan Aruch, and you did pretty well. And therefore, they figured, well, maybe over time, you'll grow to know other parts of Shulchan Aruch, and therefore, you'll be able to actually defend the pastor. Shulchan Aruch is actually given nowadays, usually, not as a certification of knowledge, but rather as a, as an incentive for you to actually learn something.
Motivation,
right.
The problem is you have people think that they can pass
you. Right, that is the problem.
I think the majority of people know.
I shouldn't be
like
3 years old.
Right. It is a problem. But the third actually went to bring that up. There was when I was interviewing some yeshivas, I went after 11th grade. I left high school in 11th grade. I went to learn in Israel. So So one guy said to me, he said, come to my yeshiva, and I'll get you, within 3 years, I'll get you smichas under the table. So, I didn't I did not go to his yeshiva.
Now they did it officially. Yeah.
What?
Now they did it officially.
I'll put it under the bus, I'll slide it to you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm left
with
it. What? It's a very hard thing to know the process. A person should be a person who's humble enough to tell you what he knows and doesn't know. And it's not so simple. It's not all people are so humble, right? But it's very hard to know somebody. As opposed to, usually it comes about because the person's recognized. I once suggested a set of three criteria. I think that sums up pretty well. One of the three. Either he's written books which indicate to the majority of the readers that he has prowess in Ishan Halachic rulings, or the majority of a certain community comes to ask him questions, and he is...
Wouldn't that require, like, if they have to check it? Like, people already come to ask him questions, then he can ask him questions. What makes them be able to ask him questions?
True. That's true. Or the third thing was, that what I was going to say, is that you're right, that's especially how you reach that stage. But some people do. The reality is that people came to the Chofetz Chaim and asked questions even though you didn't have smicha. Right? Why did they come to Chofetz Chaim and ask some questions? Because you have to the Chofetz Chaim, right? They didn't come to Chofetz Chaim overnight, but somehow, at some point along the line, people said, you know, this guy, he's pretty holy and he knows the stuff, so you know, we're going to start asking questions. Right? So many people come to ask the questions, and the answers are considered to be legitimate answers.
Because he also wrote a book.
Right. But that wasn't a... Right? That's true, he wrote a book too. Okay. So not so good as that. You're right. But and the third thing is, the third possibility is where his peers, other Rabbanim, you know, recognized him as having accomplished the... You know, they would go to him and ask him Sakh Halacha. But it's very difficult. You're right. Many times nowadays, a person who's called a rabbi has no sense of how to issue a halachic ruling.
There's a problem. Yeah.
Not much to do. There's no central certifying organization, so not much to do about that.
Now, do the rabbis in Israel, the head Ashkenazi and the head Sephardic rabbi, do they have the power to issue a halachic ruling? Because I think they do it quite a while.
They actually, you know, it used to be that the chief rabbis in Israel were considered to be very great scholars. And that's not necessarily true anymore. So I don't know exactly.
Yeah, because I don't know who these two rabbis are.
The fact we don't know them doesn't mean
they're not. No, I haven't heard anything about them. Like, if you would ask me about Baba Sali, I'd say, I read some of his books.
He wasn't a great scholar.
Huh?
He wasn't a great scholar.
Baba Sali?
He wasn't chief rabbi either.
He wasn't chief rabbi, but I still consider him a... No?
I don't think he ever passed it anything. He was a holy man. But not the same thing.
I don't stop being a great scholar, man. No?
No. They're not the same thing. People have different... People have different expertise. It's not a shocking idea. There's certain people who excel in issuing halachic rulings. Some people excel in delivering, you know, Shurim and Gemara. Certain people excel in that they're very holy people. But they're not necessarily all the same person. They don't have to be the same person. Hmm.
No, I'm processing it.
Right.
Now.
But everybody has...
I'm destroying my whole belief system.
That's okay. That's what we're here to do. But the a person has to have... Anybody, obviously, if they're going to have any degree of admiration, Judaism has to have a basic level of Yiras Shamayim. Has to have all of heaven. Right. Where then, you know, they develop an expertise based on a rudimentary law of heaven is not always the same people say next week. So Gemara already speaks about this. So the people experts in Tanakh, other people experts in Mishnayos, other people are experts in Gemara, other people are experts in Halacha. There's different expertises. It's not so simple for somebody to be, you know, the totality of everything. Sometimes you have people like that, but it's very rare. You know, the Lagon, the Rambam, you know. But those are the ones which are very rare. You don't come across them so often.
What about Rashi?
Rashi, but even Rashi at his time, he wasn't just whether he made it, he does issue a lot of real rulings, but he wasn't said to be one of the major posting of his time, right? He's, I mean, the story about a generation which, you have remember that thing was the Rambam, right? So Rashi and the Rambam, they're different. And on the other hand, the Rambam is considered to be one of the great commentators of all time. They each have their own niche, right? So it's very rare that you have somebody whose niche encompasses everything simultaneously. It's not meant to be that way, because this is a division of labor among the Jewish people. Different people are supposed to excel in different things. Otherwise, their people would be redundant. So therefore, everybody's supposed to have their specific area of expertise where they're supposed to excel. So, to sum up this topic, obviously, when we talk about Elul ve'Elul, then, the two perspectives should be correct. Even though they don't agree with one another, it has to be that they're issued by a person who is suitable, not authorized, perhaps is the wrong word, but who's suited and worthy of ruling. Such a person has to have basic Yirat Shamayim. If he doesn't have the law of heaven, doesn't get off the ground. If that person is issued to ruling, that ruling has legitimacy. It has legitimacy and it even be followed until one of the cutoff points occurs. One of the major cutoff points of Jewish history, the completion of the Mishnah, the completion of the Talmud, the Shulchan Aruch. Those are major cutoff points in Jewish history. Right? If you are able to analyze what the person said, even theoretically, to take from the past its cutoff date, but most people can't analyze. Most people just have to figure out who to follow. So therefore, they have to follow somebody who is accepted after the cutoff date in question. They can't just go back and start rearranging things, hundreds or thousands of years earlier. You can only do things in your epoch, not the epoch before. By the way, we see nowadays that literally, as we speak, there is a new epoch in Jewish law, which is the epic of those who quote others, but really don't pass them on their own, because there's so much material out there already that most stock nowadays is not brand new and fresh, but rather it is based on pre-existing tshuvas and pre-existing essays and books on the topic. So a person that does that basic Yirat Shamayim in order to establish himself, then a person has to have halachic knowledge, he's got to buy into the halachic system. Then a person can actually rule. Then it still has to be accepted by the Jewish people. Okay? Now, assuming that it's a new decree. The whole question is ruling on, so that it doesn't have to be accepted. So the idea of Elul ve'Elul is that you have multiple truths, not just one truth, multiple truths, and they all could be valid for different people at different times. And as far as the 98 ways of Talmud, the 98 ways of Torah that God gave the Jewish people when they originally gave the Torah Mount Sinai. So therefore we have...
What you just said, the
98
ways of this?
I'm sorry, 49, 49 actually should have said. The first time we did this topic, we said messages and messages says that God gave on each issue 49 ways of saying it's good, 49 ways of saying it's bad. 49 ways of saying it's kosher, 49 ways of saying it's not kosher. 49 ways of saying it's permitted, 49 ways of saying it is not permitted. Yeah.
So does that mean that certain things because they may contradict or still
right.
within a certain acceptable range?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
But paradoxes are not a bad thing. Right? Okay. Things that there's different people that are supposed to have different approaches. Not everybody's supposed to have the same approach. Okay? Now, of course, the problem is that frequently that leads to intolerance. And that's a major pitfall of not having concept of Elul. That means if I don't have a concept of Elul, and I see that, this guy is following Sephardi halacha, or any of you Sephardi in the room, so I might get upset and I say, that's not the way we do things here. You guys are wrong. Go back to Spain. So that kind of intolerance is exactly what Elul ve'Elul is meant to prevent. The idea is that everybody's derech, as long as it meets the criteria of having been generated in a sense of out of a sense of Yirat Shamayim, of all of heaven, and being done according to the proper halachic principles, is a viewpoint which requires respect. The story I brought down when I wrote this essay, which is a funny, good story, which I think captures how Jews respect one another, which is that you had Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, who was a Rav in Slutsk, and then later Rosh Shimon Shrine. It came to the Shabbos Mevarchim Parshat, I think it was Chodesh Av, I think it was. Shabbos Mevarchim Parshat Chodesh Av, which is coming up in a week, next week.
Two weeks.
So there was a machlekes in shul. You say Ava Rachmim on that Shabbos or not? In the before Ashrei on Shabbos morning, you say Ava Rachmim, which is a commemoration prayer. So we say Tzvira. because many Jews were killed during Sefirot HaOmer, we say it even on Shabbos Mevarchim. But the question is, what does it say on Shabbos Mevarchim Rosh Chodesh Av? Which is a bad time, because during the 3 weeks. But it's not the same thing in Sefirot HaOmer. So there's a big fight about it, I'm sure. Say it, don't say it. You know, in the old days, these things used to make a big difference to people. So they do say it, don't say it, do say it, don't say it. Finally came to the Rav and asked, well, Rav, what is the minhag? What's the minhag? He said, no, this is the minhag. The minhag is Shabbos Mevarchim Av comes, and everybody fights about it. So that's a classic example of Jewish tolerance, is that everybody fights together with everybody else. And but the idea is, of course, that when you're fighting with somebody else in halacha, it should not become a personal vendetta. It should just become a theoretical, you know, abstract fight. And even if you throw chairs at one another, of course, you'll come to love each other at the end. Anyway, so that's a very important lesson of Eluv. Eluv is the lesson that everybody, even if they're different, has a specific role to play, and their specific aspect might dictate that they have a different approach, but that approach has to be given honor. And as the Gemara says at the end of the Sefer, very important Gemara, the Gemara says, and I'm quoting here in the article, it says that in the world to come, that Hashem is going to make a circle for the Tzaddikim, and all Tzaddikim are going to stand in a circle, and they're going to point to Hashem in the middle, or it's not Hashem itself, whatever it is, and they say, Zek Eluv Aveiluv, this is my God, and I give him honor. So the Marsha says, why a circle? Because in a circle, all points are equidistant from the middle. The lesson is that every tzaddik has a different approach. But ultimately, as long as they're all on the same circle, and all pointing to the same place, that's what Hashem wanted. That there be many different perspectives, which all lead to the same place. Okay, we'll stop here for today.